In Paris, at the turn of the century and really through the 20s, was just a center of creative energy and innovation for writers and artists. And there was a building called I'm only reading this poem to show off my French pronunciation, which doesn't deserve to be shown off. Le Bateau Lavoir. And it was named that by Max Jacob because it was this rickety building. And just about everybody who was an artist or writer in Paris was in this building, living there, trying to make in a studio or hanging out. And among the people who were there was Guillaume Apollinaire, Jean Cocteau, Modigliani, and Picasso. With Fernand and Picasso in Le Bateau Lavoir, 1905. In his dim-lit, ramshackle studio in Montmartre, after the suicide of his friend, Cassegamas, Picasso paints nothing but blue, and not just because blue is the cheapest pigment a poor poet can find, but then he meets Fernand Olivier, and the color magenta red or rose begins to appear. Picasso wins over Fernand with his brooding eyes and opium, then explores her body in paint, form by form. Gertrude Stein tells everyone that Fernand has two subjects, hats and perfume. Picasso is 22, Fernand 23. He wants to be a father. Did she really ever want to bear a child? Perhaps, but the beatings, the falls before she met Picasso make that impossible. In the not quite last chapter, Picasso tells a friend, Fernand ditched me for a futurist. What am I going to do about the dog? Now, that is an example of semi-truthiness, okay? Okay. Because the real story goes on and on and on for years. Because she left him, then she came back, then she left him, then she came back, and then he left her. So this really, this segment of the reading is about truth and lies. Just happens to be about a theme we touched on earlier tonight. I learned the discount price of truth on a talk show in L.A. Backstage with someone dabbing makeup on my face, I'm barely 22, but eager for lights and camera, eager to hold forth on Channel 5 TV about the Vietnam War, as if I know from books of shoulder deep in rice fields or hillsides rouged with rag-torn men. With me is Rob, square-jawed and blonde, special forces back from Vietnam. We've been months around L.A. speaking against the war. A teacher now, in his throaty voice, he says, what we're doing there is wrong. That night, his students will be watching. Then the slick-haired TV host slips in to say, listen, we need more drama. We want Rob to play pro-war and you to play the peacenik. I do not walk out. I do not cry out, no bloody way. We both go on. Ambition and cowardice, how unlovely when they blend. Me afloat on a raft of practiced words while Rob half chokes in lies and flotsam. I can almost taste it on my tongue. After 40 years, when full of books on a talk show in L.A., I learned the aftersmack of shame. I pretend, next poem. I I pretend my mother is not dead, but is bartering at a West LA farmer's market, her metal shopping cart bulging with purple figs, rock hard guavas, juicy ripe persimmons. Perhaps she will trade them for brown eggs or shiny eggplant or chocolate she'll store in the freezer, because out of sight is out of mind. But my mother is buried at Holy Cross with the Catholic movie stars. She herself never met anyone famous, unless you count Colonel John Stapp, the rocket sled man. Mother liked my poems so long as I never said anything bad about NASA or Charles Lindbergh or my father. But I can't forget the double martinis my father needed to get through lunch with me at Nixon's favorite Mexican restaurant, El Adobe. Dad's new wife would share how sorry she felt for the little people. She was related somehow to a California governor. She'd been his secretary. I think she loved him and would bring him without question the vodka orange juice from the stainless Frigidaire. I would drive home repeating a kind of mantra. I am not, you are not your parents, you are not. Lucky, lucky, the fire in 91 spared all the family photos. That winter I wiped away every smudge to see my parents foolish and happy and young again. And I'm just going to read a couple more because I know it's kind of late. And Jay and I are reading next week anyway, so you guys probably need a break. Okay. This is a poem for those of you who are travelers or dream of being travelers. You got to sort of listen to see why it's about that. Eucalyptus. Growing up, we called them gum trees for the sap that seeps from any rupture in the bark. Never thought much about the pods or flowers, but rather how green all year and how everyone was different. Some spongy, string-barked, others rough and furrowed or ribboned with curls, some chalky white, crumbling like parchment, slender, pendulous leaves like the willow, gray, limber dancers, weightless in the wind. I'd idly strip the bark from trees behind the bus stop on my way to school, the scent vaguely antiseptic. Only later found their name was Greek, meaning to cover well. For how the lid or opercolium hides the bud until the flower can bloom, and so covered well they've traveled from down under to nearly every continent, preferring swamp and moisture, but enduring, quick to grow, to shape themselves to someplace new, even on the windswept desert. On California nights, I'd wake to branches beating on the frame of that old house, iron bark, blue gum, robusta. And then I guess I'll read, this is a weird poem, and you may hate this poem, but I'm going to read it anyway. It's okay. There's like 50% of the people who've read this poem go, and some others sort of like it. Okay. I'm living right in front of where they're tearing down Reisenstein School. Okay, so lots of dust. On the death of Florence Reisenstein in the spring of tulips. No dynamite, no wrecking ball, but a long-reach excavator crushing walls until beams and twisted rebar fall inexorably to earth. My dog, Daisy, and I visit every day. She sniffs the ground, chews some grass, tries to tug me down the street, but I keep resisting. It's barely May. forsythia blazing yellow and tulips in such wild and sumptuous display were nearly a new Netherlands. But something draws me to the teardown, this topology of ruin, desks, chalkboards, children gone, ravaged walls, broken girders, wiring limp and dangling like ligaments, torn tendons, water and drain pipes, arteries and veins. They flattened her once sleek and modern body, edging towards the face with its oddly squinty windows. Oh, Reisenstein, forgotten saint of the city, that far wall, a crushed rib cage, the dented furnace, an old metallic body, belly. Enough ghoulishness, says Daisy. I let her pull me towards the tulips, an immaculate blossoming of dogwoods. And finally, this is the last poem, and it, and as some lot of you know, I'm an agnostic, or I'm probably really an atheist, but there are times when you need everything you can get. So, prayer beads, anything you can bring with you. Prayer beads and stone. I dress in black with my old prayer beads, a talisman for the cemetery road, as I clear the crumpled leaves. A November sun warms my shoulders. Then a voice says, go easy. Or maybe ghost easy. As is the custom, I leave a stone. A friend brings me matryoshkas from Moscow, each smaller and smaller, nested dolls carved from wood, then painted, each a peasant girl with a green cloak and black-lashed eyes, so closely set they nearly cross. By the fourth doll, there are no lashes. By the fifth, a mouse face with insect eyes. Some days I imagine the unborn daughter. Black straight hair, long lashes, perhaps a stubborn and turbulent nature, someone who would scorn us as we grew old, or someone good at chess openings but never understands how to finish the game. I imagine her crying, asking, why does this hurt so? I imagine our answer, we don't know. Thank you.